I remember a joke that I saw on Facebook once, and it was describing the use of a comma in grammar and how important it is. And it showed two versions of the same sentence, and the first one that used the comma said, "What time are we going to eat, Grandma?" The second version left the comma out and said, "What time are we going to eat, Grandma?" Context, meaning, and interpretation are completely changed just by the use of one simple punctuation mark. A similar story that I read a little bit longer was about when Gerber Baby Food decided to start selling their products internationally. And this was maybe back in the 1950s or 60s, I'm not sure when it was. But they wanted to start selling baby food in Africa. And they did. And they used the exact same packaging and the exact same labeling that we know here on the grocery stores in the United States. It featured that iconic picture of that beautiful smiling baby girl with the wavy hair on it. In Africa, the product didn't sell at all. And it sold so badly that the campaign was halted. Nobody wanted to buy this stuff. So the company stopped and did some research. And one of the things that they learned is that in Africa there are so many different tribal languages that the way they label packages is not with words, but with a picture of what's inside the container. So you can imagine nobody wanted to buy this Gerber baby food that had a picture of a little baby girl on it. Context matters. In some cases, it matters so much, it can mean the difference between life and death, or the difference between what is virtuous and what is profane, or the difference between what is comforting and what may be terrifying. When you add in all of the nuances that can transcend across time, culture, and language, or the rules of grammar, the list is endless. For all the things that can change your interpretation, and it can make the process seem somewhat chaotic. One of the frustrations that I see when I read chat forums on the internet is that people have expressed frustration that when you're writing an opinion or responding to an article, people don't have the benefit of seeing your body language or hearing your tone of voice. Sometimes that might mean a comment that is just meant to be made in jest or with some sarcasm is taken deadly serious by somebody else who's reading it, and then a big argument over this misunderstanding can follow. We live in a world that is full of this kind of conflict, sometimes chaotic conflict. So much of it could probably be explained by a misunderstanding of intent due to context. But it is somewhat in our nature to be in this state of conflict. It seems maybe there's something in our wiring that puts us in a place of competition rather than in a place of cooperation. There can even be a sense or perception that someone else's success means that there will be less for me. It's almost as if we view life's abundant provisions that God provides not as infinite, but like slices of pizza. If we order a pizza and somebody moves in front of you in the line and grabs the biggest slice, instantly your thoughts go, "There's less for the rest of us." And the seeds for conflict are planted. And I'm not saying that that situation always results in conflict. We make choices about how to feel about that sort of thing in the moment. But our wiring still makes us aware of the unfairness of the situation. Somebody is benefiting more than they deserve, or at least more than I am. And that awareness is instant. If we choose to view our lives and our abundance only in terms of a pie chart, that when one receives a higher percentage, someone else's percentage decreases, We're not only planting seeds for the conflict, we're actually watering, nurturing, feeding, and preparing for an abundant harvest of conflict. Love is not pizza. When Zoe was born, did I have to subtract from the love that I have for Kelsey and Morgan so that I could have enough for Zoe? No. My heart grew bigger and created the room that it needed for Zoe to live there too. I spent the last week or so thinking, when I read the gospel today, that I'd really rather hear Randy or Greg try to interpret the last four verses rather than try to do it here for you myself. When I first read the readings, I thought I was lucky. We had two options for the gospel, both telling the story of the banquet, but one going much further than the shorter version. Two versions of the same story, but with very different takeaways. If we stop at chapter 10, we stop at a point where all of us who haven't rejected the initial invitation are invited. When we go to chapters 11 through 14, the tone changes. Luke tells a version of the same story. Instead of those that are invited being described as either bad or good, the new invitees in Luke's version are described as the sick and the lame. This is yet a third version or interpretation of the story. Unlike the other two in meaning and in what lesson we believe we are meant to learn. Isaiah tells us of a banquet, a feast of rich food and choice wines. That was the first reading that I reviewed this week, and I thought to myself, boy, this is going to be easy. We're all going to go to a banquet filled with rich food, choice wines, juicy, delicious food and choice wines. Come and enjoy this rich food and choice wines. That's not a tough message to deliver, right? And on that mountain, the veil is woven over all nations, will be destroyed. And Paul tells us that God will fully supply whatever we need in accord with the glorious riches of Christ Jesus. It's all going so well. And then we get to the 11th chapter of Matthew. Uh-oh. Context matters. What are we to think? That someone who accepts this invitation but does not properly conform or wear the proper attire will not be among the chosen. One of my idiosyncrasies is that I don't like to respond to something complicated without some adequate time to soak on it and ponder it. So whenever I'm presented with a complicated situation or choice and asked for an immediate opinion, if I give one, I nearly always regret the answer that I give after I've had taken some soak time and pondered it, and then I think, this is what I should have said in the moment. And the gospel had that same effect on me. So I'll tell you a little bit about some of the rules I have for myself when I pray. I think it is important to sincerely talk to God about what I want, no matter what it is. It is fair that I discuss it freely with God. I'm not telling God anything that God doesn't know. God knows my heart. But it's my responsibility to know my own heart as well and to learn about it by my experience of sharing it with God. But once I've bared my soul, my innermost thoughts or desires, my second rule is that I then end that prayer with the words, "Thy will be done." It's not about getting what I want, but acknowledging both what I want, but also understanding that I'm only a small piece of a large and mysterious puzzle that God is assembling, and that I fulfill my duty as a piece of that large, mysterious puzzle in completing this picture. Thy will be done. Many are invited, few are chosen. I ponder the mystery of what it means to be wearing the proper attire at the banquet. Perhaps it is only that I ultimately want what is God's will for me, and I will ponder that question every time I pray. I accept your invitation. What should I wear? Context matters. What do you desire for me, Lord? Thy will be done. God's love is not a pie chart and it's not a pizza. There's enough room in God's kingdom for everyone. Can I not only accept God's love, but be a part of growing it and sharing it with all of God's people? Thy will be done.